From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Here's what's coming up on this morning's forum program. New UC Berkeley Chancellor Carol Crist, the first woman to hold that position, takes the helm as the school faces major problems, including a $110 million budget deficit and a student housing shortage. The 40,000 student university has also been at the center of the free speech debate happening across the country. Crist joins us in studio for the hour to discuss her plans for UC Berkeley and explain why she deems the coming academic year a free speech year. Join us after the news. Welcome to this morning's forum program. I'm Michael Krasny. Carol T. Crist was named the chancellor of the University of California at Berkeley in March. She is Berkeley's 11th chancellor and the first woman to hold that position. She's pledged to cut the school's $110 million budget deficit in half, which could involve layoffs, and she's facing other thorny issues, such as a student housing shortage and concerns over the handling of controversial guest speakers on campus. Recently, she declared this school term a year of free speech and announced plans for a series of debates on contentious issues, among other campus events on the theme. A scholar of Victorian literature, Carol Crist first came to UC Berkeley in 1970 as an English professor. Her titles at Berkeley have included Dean of Humanities and Executive Vice Chancellor, and she left to become president of Smith College, where she served from 22 to 2013. She joins us in the studio for this forum hour, and welcome, Carol Crist.
Thank you.
Good to have you here, and congratulations on becoming not only the first woman chancellor, but I think actually the oldest chancellor on record.
Yes, that's true.
You could be retired at your age, right?
I've retired twice already.
So what's motivating? We'll talk about so many things to talk about, particularly yesterday and everything. What's motivating you to take up the chancellorship?
Well, a friend of mine often says I flunked retirement, but I'm at the time of my life when I'm giving back, and because of my long experience of Berkeley, I feel that I understand some ways forward for the campus from some of its challenges. The University of California at Berkeley made me who I am, so I feel I should give back.
Well, giving back and moving forward, I think those two do go together, and I'm sure to hear you say that. Let's talk about where you want to take it. There's all this talk now about different speakers coming. Yiannopoulos may be coming back, Ann Coulter, Steve Bannon. And yesterday, of course, was a major event that had to do with free speech. You've taken a very strong position and even at this point received a good deal of criticism for it. And the position essentially is free speech means free speech, even hate speech or what might be termed hate speech.
That's exactly right. Our Constitution has the largest guarantees of free speech of any liberal democracy. Basically, almost all speech is protected. And as a public university, we're not only obligated to protect that constitutional right, but I believe it's the right thing to protect free speech, even when there are speakers who voice things that are abhorrent, that are odious. But the right answer to hateful speech is more speech.
So instead of speech suppression, and of course you're excluding things like inciting to riot or violence of any kind, clearly, right? This means you counter it and you do what I think, in fact, you've brought up John Stuart Mill, no less. The ideas that are right will win out in the long run. You kind of put your faith in that notion.
Yes, and I think it's fundamental to our democracy that we have robust debate, that all opinions can be heard, that all opinions can be spoken. And I don't think, I mean, John Stuart Mill made two arguments. One is that the truth is of such power that it will ultimately win out. But the other is that there is no governmental authority that is of that can enjoy such trust that it can be put in the position of censoring speech.
Well, Berkeley, as you've pointed out on a number of occasions, has this whole tradition of free speech, and free speech ought to mean, in fact, free speech, but also has a kind of strange tradition. I mean, you know, my memory is long, and I remember Gene Kirkpatrick and other people who were shouted down. And the idea is if they're going to speak hatefully, to use a word that probably is a neologism, then they should be shouted down. Microaggressions can hurt people and so forth. What do you say to counter that argument?
I think the heckler's veto, or what sometimes is called platform denial, plays into a narrative of the right. I think it's the wrong way to counter hateful speech. A better way to counter it is with more speech, speech that's more powerful about the things that you believe, mockery, silent protest by just not listening. I think all of these are more powerful than shouting speakers down.
You know, I'm dating myself here, but when I was a young undergraduate, I led demonstration against George Lincoln Rockwell, who was the head of the American Nazi Party, and we just went in, we sat there, and we listened, and we got up, and we left. We were all wearing white shirts and all showing our protest by immediately walking out after the speech was over. But listening, hearing what he had to say, because the idea would be better to counter his arguments and hear what he has to say and give, or at least afford him the opportunity to at least have free speech and abide by the First Amendment. I think this is pretty much what you're saying, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. When I was at Smith, Ann Coulter came to speak at Smith. There was an outcry among the faculty. There was an outcry among the students. They wanted me to ban Ann Coulter from campus, to disinvite her. I insisted that Ann Coulter had been legitimately invited and had a right to speak at Smith. We had the event was in the largest auditorium at Smith. It held about 2,000 people. And the students developed what I thought was a brilliantly creative protest. They filled the auditorium initially. Every 5 minutes in her speech, a group would stand up silently, turn their backs, stand silently with their backs turned, and then leave the auditorium silently. And by the end, there was almost nobody listening.
That would have been even better with George Lincoln Rockwell. We're talking with Carol Chris, the new chancellor of UC Berkeley, and essentially she's taking the position and has made this position very clear and articulated it a number of times that the university can't and should not essentially shelter students from ideas that may be wrong or dangerous, and you may indeed want to comment on that. Let's talk about some of the other big issues, though, that are certainly fraught at the University of California and throughout the country, sexual harassment scandals at your university, unfortunately. And at this point, you've come out and said this behavior is can't be tolerated, won't be tolerated.
Yes, this behavior is unacceptable. It creates an inequitable education for what are mostly largely women students that are harassed, and it's unacceptable. I think the road to making it much more unacceptable in our culture is a lot of education and very good procedures. We've been working for over a year to make our procedures even more responsive to complainants and to work more effectively and more quickly.
Has to be less tolerance for this kind of behavior, but there also has to be a willingness not to stay silent.
That's exactly right. I mean, I've heard so much about open secrets. Individuals and departments that everyone knows behave inappropriately. And we have to not have open secrets anymore. We have to be willing to speak out. And there's been a sea change publicly about this. If you think about the women in Silicon Valley, the women in Fox News, of the accusers of Bill Cosby, women at one point were ashamed of being sexually harassed. But now women are willing to speak out and say, this shouldn't happen to me. This is inappropriate, and it violates my rights.
What do you say to those women students, though, who say, I just don't feel safe? I mean, because many of them, just in a general sense of sort of breathing the air they breathe, feel a sense of intimidation or not lack of safety.
Well, I think we have two obligations. One is to make sure the environment is safe, and that means that there is ready and well-known access to both people that can help them, help the student with any measures that would change their environment from whatever is the threat to them, but also complaint procedures. And then it's also really important to cultivate in everyone in our student body, indeed everyone in the Berkeley community, an inner resilience that's the surest form of safe space.
We're talking again, if you just joined us, with the new chancellor of UC Berkeley, Carol Crist, and we do invite your involvement in this program. In fact, let me give the phone number now, because I know there are many of you who want to weigh in on these two big issues that we've just touched upon, or speak with the chancellor or ask questions of her. Our toll-free number is available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and you can be part of this program and join the conversation with any questions or comments. We do invite you. Again, it's 866-733-6786, or email us now, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website and post any questions or comments onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Or, of course, you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. You've got some real also cost of living concerns, I know, and housing concerns, and there's just so much to really bring into the light here in our conversation. But let's talk first about the deficit, because we went under Nick Dirks from, unfortunately, surplus to a deficit, and this is something you've inherited. You've talked a lot about finding new revenue streams. You've talked a lot about not wanting to do the kind of cuts that were done under Chancellor Dirks. Talk about how you picture really bringing things into more balance, at least financially.
Well, first, let me correct something that you said. Nick Dirks did not come into a budget with a surplus. He came into a budget with a deficit. The deficit has been a fairly long-standing since really the since the recession 2008.
Thank you for that correction. The deficit has expanded under him. That's really what
yes,
I
the deficit
say,
expanded,
yes.
but it was there in the beginning. Yeah. Okay. And I want to set some context for your question because it's so important for the University of California at Berkeley. The University of California used to work with a very generously funded state budget that had multiple revenue sources that were designated for specific uses. So you had money for faculty positions, you had money for deferred maintenance, you had money for temporary academic staffing, which means lecturers and graduate student instructors. You had money for janitorial work, the upkeep. You had money for student services. And these funding streams were all generous. They all relied on a formula, and they couldn't be mixed. Now we're in a very, very different budget situation in which we get our budget in a block from the state, and all dollars are green. We can use dollars for our highest priority, but with that comes less generous state funding. So I believe that we have to create a mixed revenue environment in which we multiply and diversify revenue streams at the same time that we never lose our focus on our public mission and the fact that we're a public institution. We're having great success with that. Of the reduction of $54 million that we have to make in the coming academic year, we've reached 52% of that goal through revenues.
Well, you've had a new funding stream, I know, for deferred maintenance, for example, right?
Yes, yeah. Yes, that's right.
But there's been too much dependency. I mean, I've heard the argument a number of times on this program, obviously, about money coming from out-of-state tuition. Are you going to decrease that dependency? Make it more possible for kids within California to go to UC Berkeley?
The regions have capped the percentage of out-of-state students at its current level. That's 24.4%. I think that's right. I think we exist to serve the people of the state of California. But there's a different challenge, which I think it's important for your listeners to be aware of. UCLA and Berkeley this year had over 100,000 applications for places in their undergraduate class. It doesn't take a mathematical genius to figure out that there are going to be many more disappointed kids than kids that are happy. And I think when a university gets that competitive, it's hard to maintain a sense that it's a state resource. So one of the most important challenges in front of the whole University of California, I believe, is enrollment capacity. As the population of the state continues to grow, as more and more young men and women think that a college, a university education is essential for economic success, and as our graduation rates rise for underrepresented minorities, we need more places. So I think that's a big challenge for the system.
What are you going to do about those low numbers of we've got 3% black students at UC Berkeley, 6% statewide? I mean, and I know you're committed to diversity, but that's really lower than the other UC campus. I think it's the lowest, in fact, in the UC system.
Yes, it is. In part, that's because of Berkeley's competitiveness, but in part, it's because we have five different undergraduate colleges, each with their own admission system and process. That said, I think we can and should do more. We can increase our outreach to high schools where there are lots of underrepresented students, and we can increase our yield rates.
What are you going to do about increasing housing? I mean, you got a real crisis there, don't you?
We certainly do have a real crisis. We house only 22% of our undergraduate students. That's the lowest percentage by far in the UC system. When I was the interim provost, I chaired a task force focused on housing. We need to double the number of beds that we have. So we're now developing a comprehensive plan for expansion of housing. I think it's the single most important thing that we can do to enhance the quality of undergraduate experience. Too many of our students are living in housing that's too crowded, too far away, too expensive. They compromise other needs like food and books. I encounter increasing numbers of homeless students. It's a real crisis because the housing market in Berkeley and more generally in the East Bay is so impacted. Even if you have the money to pay for housing, it's sometimes very hard to find.
Well, you've talked, I know, about alliances not only with the city of Berkeley, but also with Oakland. And I know there's a new dormitory in the works, but what about People's Park? Is that verboten, or is that a real possibility?
I've been raising the question of People's Park. I think, first, the most important thing is to work collaboratively with the city in addressing the problem of homelessness in the park. I recently watched the movie Berkeley in the 60s and was so struck by the difference between the idealism that had motivated the creation of the People's Park and the park as it exists today. So that I believe that we should be first trying to address the issue of homelessness. I've hired a social worker that works collaboratively with the city to address that problem. Ideally, I would like to see supportive housing for the homeless on the park, as well as a piece that's a park and a memorial and student housing.
Let me bring a caller on here. Mary joins us as our first caller up this morning. Mary, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I want to congratulate the chancellor for her new position, and I wanted to share that in 1969, my older brother was a graduate of UC Berkeley. He was part of People's Park in the 60s, and after a very long and difficult time, he was ready to graduate, and the entire class, nearly, got up and walked out of the stadium prior to their receiving of their diplomas because they continued to protest against the regents and chancellor continuing support of the Vietnam War. And my father, afterwards, we found my brother, of course, was crushed that his firstborn son, having worked hard to get his honors in English, didn't go through that ceremony. And Grandma was there. But what my father said made so much sense to me, which was, you know, you've undermined the Constitution by not staying and listening. You should have.
Mary, I think we lost the connection there, but I thank you for that narrative and appreciate your call. I think she's pretty much reinforcing what you're saying, Chancellor Crist. But here's a listener who says, who's going to pay for free speech? The students, the taxpayers, the businesses? Has she ever managed a large disturbance? Is she prepared for the consequences? This is a large campus in the midst of a metropolitan area. Giving parity to hate speech is provocative and offensive.
Well, free speech is not free, particularly in our current political situation where there is conflict often between people with different political interests, but I feel it's critical for Berkeley to be able to allow people with a diversity of viewpoints to speak on campus, and we will make the investments to keep the campus safe and secure and to protect the right of free speech.
I believe it cost $100,000 when Yiannopoulos was here to speak, though. I mean, just in terms of damage and the...
Yes, that's
the kind of destruction was. So I think that's the spirit of what this gentleman is asking, maybe.
Free speech is not free, and we believe so strongly in the safety and security of our campus and the right of free speech that we are going to make the investments that are important to protect it. I hope once we do this successfully, once or twice, we won't have to make those security investments.
You know, we're coming up on a break here, but I was reading the Daily Cal, and they were saying very positive things, laudatory things about you and your record and so forth. But then they kind of brought up a question of trust. They said that Janet Napolitano let them down. They were talking, of course, about the money in the audit that appeared, and they said that Nick Dirks let them down, building around a fence. I mean, using these kind of almost metaphors for problems with what they had invested their trust in. And what do you say to students, for example, who take that attitude? Can we trust her?
I think that trust is built on both words and actions. I intend to be a very present chancellor. I'll be having open hours and I really want to engage any group that wants to talk with me. But trust
open
is
door?
Open door.
That's certainly admirable. Can you also talk about, since we're speaking about open doors, as I said, we're coming up on a break, but you want to have a greater role for UC Berkeley in terms of ties to Sacramento. What does that mean?
That means developing relationships with legislators, not when there's a crisis, but just when in the normal run of business. I think we share many goals with the legislature in terms of the University of California and Berkeley in particular.
Here's a listener who says, Carol Chris should be talking about the exorbitantly high student's tuition instead of talking about cutting the deficit. UC is rated one of the best universities in the world. We are changing the nature of the university to one for rich and elites. We, the people of California, pay enough taxes that we should make UC free for our kids.
Well, UC, any college or university is not free. The question is who pays. So it used to be that the state paid. There are basically three funding sources in higher education. There is the state. There is the tuition that students and their families pay. And there is philanthropy. We've seen a dramatic change in American higher education in the proportion of those three funding sources, at the same time that we've seen a growth in the financial need of our student bodies. This is a huge public policy issue in our state and in our nation. But to say college should be free is not an argument that goes far enough. If you say college should be free to students and their families, then you figure out, then you have to say who should pay.
Senator Sanders said it, and it still echoes in many people's consciousness, to be sure. And we're talking, if you've just joined us, with Carol Chris. She's the new chancellor at UC Berkeley, and we are going to go to your calls and emails when we return. I remind you, you can join us either by phone at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org. You can also post questions or comments right onto our Facebook page or onto our website, kqed.org/forum. And when we return, we'll hear more from you. You're listening to the Forum program on KQED. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with Carol Chris, the new chancellor of UC Berkeley. And in April, there was a critical state audit, Chancellor, that found the UC president Napolitano's office had used misleading budget practices. I mentioned this. I alluded to it. Actually, we talked about it with President Napolitano, amassing an undisclosed surplus of $175 million. Is this going to hurt your chances for more state money?
I trust the legislature can understand the issues that surfaced in the state audit to call the The reserve, a surplus, I think is misleading. Most of those monies were committed to specific programs and purposes, just like when you, you know, put money aside for some kind of purchase as a household. It's not exactly a surplus. It's money that's reserved for a purpose. This state audit had a number of recommendations that I thought would make our financial practices better and more transparent. It's not just the Berkeley campus that is changing its financial model, but rather the whole system. And therefore, we have budget practices in part through the kind of accretion of years of, you know, sometimes separate administrative decisions that have led to less transparent financing for the University of California in a much more mixed revenue environment than used to be the case. And we're frankly all of us working to answer that challenge, to meet that challenge.
You mean the challenge of transparency.
The challenge of transparency. I believe in transparency. We've put all our budget documents at Berkeley up online. Anybody can look at them. And I'm committed to making the budget of each of our units as transparent as possible for the campus community.
And we go to more of our callers. Curtis joins us. Curtis, welcome.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. So I wanted to take a bit of umbrage with something you said and then actually propose a mechanism by which the problem could be solved. So specifically, I wanted to respond to when you were asked about low enrollment of Black students at UC Berkeley. Your response was that UC Berkeley admissions is competitive. So I feel like at the very least, that response is insufficient, and at the most, that might actually be slightly racist. However, there is a mechanism in the state that can help us counteract those biases that we have, and that is the junior college or community college transfer system. So as far as I know, the university at Berkeley has one of the lowest transfer rates of students from that program. And I'm wondering if you're planning on expanding that enrollment. And I would just say, as a graduate student at UC Davis, that takes a large number of such students. They're often the best students I will have in my class and quite a joy to have around campus.
Curtis, thank you for the call. Let's hear from the chancellor.
I'm a little bit puzzled by your question because Berkeley has the most robust transfer pool in the UC system. We have a 2-to-1 ratio of upper division students to lower division students, and that 2-to-1 ratio is built upon our transfer population. I couldn't agree more. In all of the decades that I taught at Berkeley, transfer students were my favorite students. They were just each one had a different story, a different journey that brought him or her to Berkeley. They were really extraordinary and deeply, deeply satisfying to teach.
I just let me thank Curtis for the call. I just gave a talk recently up at Santa Rosa Junior College, as invited by former Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey, who's involved in a program to try to help underprivileged kids get junior college education. And there's such an important connection of that to the UC system. I mean, it can't be underplayed, and it needs to be enhanced.
Well, that's a really interesting argument, and yes, in general, I agree with it. But there is was a report that was done a number of years ago that has within it some analysis that the percentage of places in four-year institutions in relationship to the size of the state's population. And in that ranking, California is number 50 out of 50 states. In other words, in relationship to the size of its population, California has fewer places in four-year institutions, both public and private, than any other state. Research shows that if you take a group of students that have equal qualifications, one of them starting in a four-year institution, one of them starting in a two-year institution with the intention of earning a four-year degree, the group that starts in a four-year institution has a much higher rate of degree completion than the group that starts in the two-year institution.
Well, that makes perfect perfect sense. But it's always been a pipeline, particularly for underprivileged and underserved communities to make their way into D.C.
Absolutely. But what I'm questioning is whether the state of California needs to think hard about the number of places that it's providing in its four-year institutions and not only the transfer function.
It does need to think hard about that. Let's think hard about bringing some more callers in. Here we go next to Oakland. Gabby, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. So my question is about who has their free speech guaranteed. So the chancellor noted, for instance, that she would be rethinking the safety, security procedures for reinviting alt-right and, dare I say, neo-fascist speakers like Ann Coulter and Milo Yiannopoulos to campus. This is coming on the heels of multiple years of UC Berkeley and other UC campuses cracking down hard on the free speech of students who are standing up for progressive and justice-based causes, whether it's I'm a grad student at Davis, so obviously the pepper spray incident looms large, although that same year Berkeley beat back its own students with batons who were protesting for free tuition. The Black Lives Matter protests in 2014 were met very similarly. Or last year, your predecessor canceled and then uncanceled a student-led course on Palestine. And Chancellor Dirks, as well as chancellors across the UC system, have very much chilled student speech on divestment from companies complicit in Israel's occupation of Palestine. And so I'm wondering, whose free speech are you really planning to protect with these new security policies, which I assume means more armed police on campus?
I think free speech is a genuinely complex and very difficult issue. I understand the arguments that people make, similar to yours, that free speech can be perceived by some members of the community as reinforcing the power of elites. Nonetheless, I have a libertarian view of free speech because of the arguments that I made earlier in this program. I think the answer to the protection that individuals with conservative, not only conservative views, views that I think are hateful, odious, abhorrent, is more speech. It's providing platforms for the students, for people who are advocating for traditionally marginalized groups in our society to be able to speak to the community. The incidents at Davis and the incidents at Berkeley, certainly at Berkeley, created a change in how we police student protests. And we now use the Robinson-Edley rules, named after the two faculty members that chaired that committee in which we protect life and property.
There is an article in, and let me thank Gabby for her call. There's an article in yesterday's Wall Street Journal. It's about Richard Epstein, who is a long First Amendment crusader, really, and an academic at Columbia and New York University. The First Amendment is for neo-Nazis, too, is the title of the article, which I think is pretty much your position. He says, what should have been done at Berkeley is should have said, we'll call in reinforcements, we'll bring out the National Guard if necessary, but we're not going to allow any group to intimidate and change the way in which campuses work. And the way campuses work, he argues, should be free speech. End of story. That's pretty much what you're saying. But then he goes into this whole thing about microaggressions, and Richard Epstein says it drives him nuts, you know, but he says there are many people who do feel that this is an assault on them, makes them feel less safe. Yiannopoulos, for example, was really singling out transgendered people and saying terrible things about them. I mean, it's abhorrent to a point where you almost are sickened by it. So what do you do? You call in the National Guard if necessary, then you get into expenses and you get into costs, and you have to keep out the people who are not students, who wear black uniforms and masks and so forth and want to wreak destruction.
Well, just because you have the right to say something doesn't mean that it's right to say it. And we need to have deep, engaged conversation as a community about our community values. We have to put as many resources into giving opportunities for those voices that can call attention to the many ways in which microaggressions, unconscious biases manifest themselves in our daily environment. We have the responsibility for creating a harassment-free workplace and educational setting for our students, for our faculty. Nonetheless, the United States Constitution guarantees free speech in an extraordinarily broad range, that it only limits free speech where there is the threat of direct physical harm that can issue from that speech. It doesn't protect from emotional harm, though emotional harm is real. And I understand the views that that people express, that someone like Milo Yiannopoulos or Ann Coulter is deeply hurtful, that they are reinforcing decades, sometimes even centuries of discrimination by the ways in which they talk.
And speaking hate speech, the argument goes.
Yes.
This is hate speech.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but Germany, the United Kingdom, New Zealand, Denmark have laws against hate speech. The United States does not. You can argue that maybe that's wrong and we should, but that's not what the law is.
Also, important distinction, because people bring up Google and the young man who went on essentially a kind of manifesto about women, biological assumptions about women, and all the rest of that. And they said, but this is a corporation. This is not a public university. So I think people really have to realize that line needs to be drawn as well. Let me go to more of our callers, though, and let's go to Mirko, San Jose. You're on. Morning.
Hi, good morning. I'm a student at San Jose State. I actually have a question on how to approach a teacher that I believe is kind of limiting free speech. The first day of class last week, she made it very clear that certain subjects were off limits in this seminar class, where sometimes the students teach the class, and certain terms as well. And although I don't agree with bigotry and racism and all that other, all that other stuff, I think it's really important to engage those ideas in intellectual debate, especially at a public university. So I'm wondering how I could go about and, confront this teacher or tell her that it's not okay to be limiting free speech without flunking the class. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
All right. We thank you for the call, Chancellor.
I would suggest that you go talk to the teacher in his or her office hours and express your concerns. There is certainly academic freedom that faculty enjoy to structure their classes in the way that they think is appropriate. So, for example, if I were teaching a course in the Victorian novel, something that I did, and students wanted to talk about, contemporary tax reform, I could say, no, that really is inappropriate to the subject of the class. I have a sense, even though your question wasn't very detailed, that you mean something different.
I think he probably means political correctness.
And I would first talk to the faculty member. Not in a confrontational way, but in his or her office hours, and ask the faculty member if the class can have a discussion of those restrictions. I think that we have to have hard conversations. So much of free speech at Berkeley is associated with the bullhorn in Sproul Plaza. Not enough with those hard conversations among people who have different points of view in a setting that's a seminar room or a living room.
Here's Noel, a listener, who writes, I'm worried that the UC administrators are overspending money for their own benefit, and this undermines public support for our public higher education system. I don't include Dr. Christ. I think she's the best person to lead Cal. Although your base salary is over $500,000. Some people raise their eyebrows at that.
Mm. Well, I'm giving a large part of it back to the university.
What about overspending, though? I mean, the listener brings up that whole concern, and it is a concern.
Well, if you have a deficit of $110 million, you don't overspend. In fact, we've been working very hard to responsibly reduce the University of California Berkeley's budget, as well as to generate more revenues. Our highest priority is the teaching and research, and administrative dollars are the dollars that should have, I mean, obviously within the context of running the campus effectively, but they should have the lowest priority in terms of expenditure.
What about that, shall we say, balance between teaching and research? I mean, there's certainly been a good deal of complaining through the years that you want to get the best professors, and you do get the best professors, and it's more difficult, more competitive, but you often get at them at the cost of less and less teaching. I mean, because their research dollars go into the classroom, often mean they don't go into the classroom. That in other words, somebody who is a Nobel Prize recipient is teaching maybe one class a year or something along those lines. And I'm not, you know, using hyperbole here. This is actually a fact in many
cases. The Nobel Prize winners who are active faculty members, Saul Perlmutter teaches a big undergraduate class. Randy Sheckman, very active in the classroom. And the extraordinary advantage, privilege that Berkeley gives to its students is the opportunity to study with these people, to study with the people who are not just well-versed in the knowledge of their field, they're creating the knowledge in their fields. So I believe that teaching is the primary mission of the University of California at Berkeley. It's why we exist. It's why we were founded. But research is also our mission. It's how we contribute, not just to the state of California, but to the nation and the world.
Well, it's cheering to hear you say that. Teaching is what's important and really primary. Tom writes, why can't Berkeley raise more funds from friends and alumni? Roughly what percentage of Berkeley's revenues come from endowment earnings and annual gifts? And does the development department need to be more aggressive?
We certainly see philanthropy as a critical piece of our revenue strategy moving forward, and we'll be increasing the amount of funds we raise.
And we'll increase more callers by going to Oakland and welcoming Sam. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a Cal alumnus and played lacrosse at Cal on the men's lacrosse team, which is a club sports program. I'm involved in the alumni group. And I'm curious about the chancellor's comments about the competitive club sports program. I know there's been a lot of comments and discussion about the athletics program, the varsity program, and the financial difficulties on that front. And I'm not particularly interested in sort of relitigating that point. But the club sports program is entirely self-funded and has a very active alumni group and is self-sustaining and keeps the student part of the experience at the forefront. And I guess I'm just curious about the role of competitive club sports on campus.
They play a very critical role. I mean, one of my first visits, I've been going around, walking around campus, visiting different departments and units. One of the first that I visited was the RSF, the Recreational Sports Facility, and heard lots about the club sports, actually saw the badminton team play a match. I think that that's an extraordinarily valuable piece of the student experience, part of the student experience, and I certainly intend to support it.
What about the state of the overall athletic department at UC Berkeley as you see things coming in as chancellor?
The athletic department, as it's been widely reported in the press, has a deficit of about $22 million. So an important part of our deficit. $18 million of that is the stadium debt payments. I'm currently gathering input on several questions. One is whether the seismic portion of that debt should be taken onto the campus books. I don't think that there is any other seismic reinforcement, any project for seismic reinforcement of a building where we've asked the unit to pay for that seismic reinforcement. Another question that I'm considering is the prong by which we meet the requirements of Title IX. We're currently in prong three, which...
I'm sorry, what does it mean, prong three?
Prong three means that if you have a group of women athletes who show interest in a particular sport defined by a set of criteria, that you have to then offer that sport. The trouble with prong three is you can't control your capital expenses, because when you add a sport, you often have large capital expenses with that support. Prong one is the prong of proportionality, you have to have the same proportion of spots in on your varsity teams as reflects the proportion of men and women in the student body.
Is cutting sports altogether on the table at all?
Not at the moment. I mean, I think it should be a last resort, but there are a lot. There's lots of work that we have to do on the athletic department budget. I am committed to a balanced budget in athletics. I've told them that their budget must be balanced by 2020 when the campus's budget must be balanced. So we're working on that.
There's a listener who says, how will Chancellor Chris respond if Milo Yiannopoulos reads names of undocumented students as he said he would last year? How will she protect students?
I think it would be completely inappropriate to single out students. I was heartened that Milo Yiannopoulos said he did this once at the University of Wisconsin and thought it was a mistake. I think it would be a terrible violation of students' rights and privacy were he to identify students by name.
But you can't necessarily control him.
Well, once he's talking, no, yeah. You can't.
And a tweet from Danny who says, my daughter could not get the classes she needed to graduate because the classes were full. How do you address unavailability of classes?
That's one of my highest priorities. I believe that students must have the classes that they need to graduate in a timely way.
And another caller, Stephen, joining us from San Diego. Stephen, welcome.
Hi. So I wanted to go back to the whole disparagement between students that start at two-year colleges and don't finish their degrees. I feel like I'm a community college student off at Grossmont College in El Cajon, and one of the biggest reasons I chose to do a different major and not do medical school was because I was looking at over 4 years community college-level classes in order to transfer to a UC or a CSU. So personally and with my classmates and people that I talk to, that was the biggest reasons why they're going alternate routes while they're looking for private universities. It's because it takes so long. And then there's also that issue of, okay, we have to start with, you know, the prerequisite English and math and all that. But UC won't transfer that. So that also doesn't count towards our transfer. So I was wondering if you had maybe looked at a solution to this, possibly opening up more. I tuned in the middle of you talking about transfer students. But I don't know if I missed something, but maybe opening up more classes or opening up transfer to sophomore level transfers instead of junior level, because I personally think that's a big issue for me.
Yeah, thank you very much for that for that statement. The whole University of California is seeking to address the problem that you raised by creating transfer routes into every major. Making sure that students can enter at the junior level fully prepared for it with the right classes, then it's up to the community colleges to make sure that they are providing those classes for transfer students. We're deeply committed to enabling students to complete their degrees, those students who transfer from community colleges in 4 years.
And let me thank the caller. Go to more of your calls in just a moment, but I'm looking at a tweet here from Blake who says, I'm curious about more specifics from the chancellor regarding diversifying revenue streams. And I know that you're on the record as saying you don't necessarily want to eliminate jobs or merge departments, as Chancellor Dirks did. And the cuts are not necessarily the way to solve the financial challenges. So how to enhance revenues, how to find new diverse streams of revenue?
Yeah, there are basically six revenue streams that we're looking to increase. The first is non-degree enrollment, largely through university extension and summer session. The second are self-supporting degree programs, self-supporting master's programs. The third is the monetization of real estate. The fourth is entrepreneurial activity, startups, patent revenue. The fifth is increasing contract and grant activity. And the sixth is increasing philanthropy and focusing on philanthropy to support the core.
And here's Josh from Berkeley. Josh, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much, Michael. First, I just wanted to thank the chancellor. You know, I'm a Berkeley resident, and I thought the silencing of the different voices last year on the campus was just disgraceful. And I was really insulted that folks denied me the opportunity to hear voices that I don't agree with and denied me the opportunity to challenge those voices. So I really applaud your bold platform here. My question is, are you having conversations with other schools in the UC system to adopt a similar agenda when it comes to free speech? And then also, is there anything you know, me as a Berkeley resident, or anything I can do to back you up in your efforts?
Well, thank you very much for that support. I think that the situation of free speech is very different at different campuses. Berkeley, for better or worse, is the icon of free speech, so it's an attractive place for speakers to come who have extreme views. So we have a different challenge than other campuses have, but I've been in dialogue with a number of both chancellors and presidents across the United States since I made the statement that I made about free speech.
And let me thank the caller. And here's John, who writes, thanks to Chancellor Crist, who was my student advisor at Cal when I was an undergrad back in the mid-70s. Her sage advice helped me to be a successful career and life. Go Bears. She'll do a great job, I have no doubt. Actually,
it's wonderful to hear.
you're gonna find time to do the. I know you're studying piano and viola, right?
Right.
I mean, so much on your shoulders now. You're gonna find time for things like that?
I try. I can't say that I practiced quite as assiduously in the past 2 months as I practiced before then, but I believe balance is important in everyone's life, no matter how intense and challenging it is. And music has always been a space where I get in touch with my deepest self.
Also, as a scholar of Victorian literature, I always wonder, I mean, I never, as an academic, never had the interest of moving into the administrative world. But so many presidents, so many higher-ups, provosts and so forth, are people in literature. I wonder whether there's a connection or a correlation.
Well, students of literature are students of storytelling. I believe that I'm basically the storyteller in chief as the chancellor of Berkeley. You also become enormously sensitive to language.
We'll let that storyteller in chief as your synonymous title in addition to chancellor hold. And thank you very much for being with us, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
We have another hour ahead. We're going to talk about Harvey in the hour ahead in the first segment, and then we're going to move from that to talk about what happened at Berkeley yesterday. And we get back into these free speech issues, but also we'll get some reportage for you. Stay tuned. That's all coming up after the news. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, who believe that all people deserve access to education and culture to enrich a lifetime of exploration and learning.